Esther is the story of a Jewish girl who becomes queen of Persia and saves her people from annihilation by an evil man named Haman. And this story is the basis for the Feast of Purim, which took place this year on February 25th and 26th. And they celebrate the Feast of Purim with great feasting and giving and receiving gifts, and also reading the book of Esther like we're doing here today. And every time when the Jewish people would read through the book of Esther at the Feast of Purim, whenever the name Haman came up, they would stomp their feet or rattle noisemakers to try and blot out the name of Haman. And his name is used over 50 times, so you can imagine it's quite a lively reading of the book of Esther. You don't have to do that here today, but if you feel led to, that's totally fine with me. It's a story of God's hand of protection over his chosen people. It's like you just see that woven within the story, how he sovereignly is guiding things behind the scene. And yet, God's name is never mentioned in the book of Esther. And the word God is never used in the book of Esther. And also, Esther is never quoted in the New Testament, as many of the Old Testament books are. Add on top of that, that of all of the books of the Old Testament, they were found in the Dead Sea Scrolls, all of them except the book of Esther. Yet, it has been widely received as inspired scripture throughout Jewish and Christian history. What might be considered chance is clearly seen as the sovereign providential hand of God in delivering his chosen people from annihilation. It's one of the three post-exile books, Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther. The children of Israel went into captivity at the hands of the Babylonians. They were there for 70 years, and after 70 years, Zerubbabel led back about 50,000 of them. And then about 50 years after that, the events in the book of Esther takes place. And then about 20 years after the events of the book of Esther, you have Ezra returning, and a little bit after that, Nehemiah returning to build up the people spiritually and to also build the walls of Jerusalem, Jerusalem's defenses. So the book of Esther is really about this Persian leader who wants to annihilate the Jews, and this Jewish queen is raised up to be able to save her people. You know, it's an old story, but it has modern relevance, doesn't it? Because Persia is modern-day Iran. And Iran, some of the leaders of Iran have stated that they would like to have Israel wiped off the face of the map, to wipe them off of the earth. And so things haven't really changed a whole lot, have they? And just as God sovereignly is moving in this book to save his people, I believe the same thing is going to happen. And the reason I believe that is because in Ezekiel 38 and 39, we have the battle of Gog and Magog. And that is prophetic from our vantage point. It's where modern-day Russia and modern-day Iran with the Muslim nations of northern Africa gather together to attack Israel. And God comes and sovereignly turns them away. And that's something that I believe would be in the not-too-distant future. And it's really not too hard to think that scenario through, is it? When you think about Russia and Iran teaming up together and the hatred that is in the Middle East towards the Jewish people, how they would like to get rid of them. But God has a plan for them, and God is going to sovereignly protect them, just like we see here in the book of Esther. So here in the book of Esther, it starts with a great feast. We're introduced to two of the key players. It's going to be King Ahasuerus and also Queen Vashti. Esther chapter 1, verse 1. Now it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus. This was the Ahasuerus who reigned over 127 provinces from India to Ethiopia. In those days when King Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan the citadel, that in the third year of his reign he made a feast for all his officials and servants, the powers of Persia and Media, the nobles and the princes of the provinces being before him. When he showed the riches of his glorious kingdom and the splendor of his excellent majesty for many days, 180 days in all. And when these days were completed, the king made a feast lasting 7 days for all the people who were present in Shushan the citadel, from great to small in the court of the garden of the king's palace. Ahasuerus is the Xerxes of history. This feast would correspond with the great feast that Xerxes had before he went and invaded Greece. Greece is going to be the next world power that will come on the scene years later. And so he's gathered together his leaders, his officials, undoubtedly to go over the battle plan of the invasion. And while the people are there, he's showing off the riches of his kingdom, how glorious his kingdom is. And he has one trophy that he really wants to show off to all the guys that are there, and that's his queen. And so Vashti is summoned to come parade before the guys. We jump ahead now to verse 10, and it says, on the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded seven eunuchs who served in the presence of King Ahasuerus, verse 11, to bring Queen Vashti before the king, wearing her royal crown in order to show her beauty to the people and the officials, for she was beautiful to behold. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command brought by his eunuchs. Therefore, the king was furious, and his anger burned within him. Now, in a sense, you can't really blame her. I mean, here's a drunken group of guys, and she doesn't want to go and be paraded in front of all these guys and hear them going, woo, woo, man, she really is beautiful, isn't she? And so she's like, I ain't going. And so the king, and understandably so with the king, he's furious about it because the queen has disobeyed his command. And so he looks to his counselors, to his wise men, and go, what do you think we ought to do about this? What should we do to Queen Vashti? And they're going, you know, we got to do something, because if you let her get away with this, all of our wives are going to start doing things like that. So this is what you need to do. You need to get rid of the queen, and then you need to hold a beauty contest and bring all of the pretty girls from throughout the empire, and you pick one of them to be the new queen. And this is how Esther comes into the story. So we're introduced to Esther in chapter 2, and also her cousin who raised her, Mordecai. And we're going to jump into chapter 2, beginning from verse 5, Esther chapter 2, verse 5, where it says, in Shushan the citadel, there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite. Kish had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captives who had been captured with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. And Mordecai had brought up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman was lovely and beautiful. When her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So it was when the king's command and decree were heard, and when many young women were gathered at Shushan, the citadel, under the custody of Haggai, that Esther also was taken to the king's palace, into the care of Haggai, the custodian of the women. Now the young woman pleased him, and she obtained his favor, so he readily gave beauty preparations to her, besides her allowance. Then seven choice maidservants were provided for her from the king's palace, and he moved her and her maidservants to the best place in the house of the women. Esther had not revealed her people or family, for Mordecai had charged her not to reveal it. And so we find Esther here, the cousin of Mordecai. If you notice, Mordecai is from the tribe of Benjamin, which also the first king of Israel, King Saul, was from the tribe of Benjamin. Esther's Hebrew name is Hadassah, which means myrtle, and her Persian name, Esther, means star. And as she's taken, because she's so beautiful, she finds favor in the eyes of the custodian of the harem, this man named Haggai. And Mordecai had instructed Esther not to reveal the fact that she was Jewish, and that's going to play into the story as we move on. And so she ultimately has her time to come before the king, and the king likes her and makes her the new queen. If we jump down to verse 17 of chapter 2, it says, the king loved Esther more than all the other women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all of the virgins. So he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. So now she's positioned to be in a spot where she can ultimately help her people. Now, there's an incident at the end of chapter 2. It seems like it's insignificant, but it becomes very significant as the story moves on. And this is where Mordecai, and again, he's raised Esther as his own daughter, and he's concerned about her. So he is hanging out in the king's gate, and while he's there, he overhears an assassination attempt against the king's life. We see that in verse 21 of Esther chapter 2, where it says, in those days, while Mordecai sat within the king's gate, two of the king's eunuchs, Bigthan and Teresh, doorkeepers, became furious and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. So the matter became known to Mordecai, who told Queen Esther, and Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. And when an inquiry was made into the matter, it was confirmed, and both were hanged on a gallows. And it was written in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. And so it seems insignificant at this point, but it'll become really important later on because this is written down that Mordecai basically stepped in to save the life of the king. That brings us to chapter 3. And in chapter 3, we're introduced to the last player, main player, if you will, in this story, and that is the antagonist, the evil man, Haman. All right, okay. So here in chapter 3, he is the going to be like the second most powerful man here in Persia, just next to Ahasuerus. Chapter 3, after these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, and advanced him and set his seat above all the princes who were with him. And all the king's servants who were within the king's gate bowed and paid homage to Haman, for so the king had commanded concerning him. But Mordecai would not bow or pay homage. Then the king's servants who were within the king's gate said to Mordecai, "Why do you transgress the king's command?" Now it happened when they spoke to him daily, and he would not listen to them, that they told it to Haman to see whether Mordecai's words would stand. For Mordecai had told them that he was a Jew. When Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow or pay him homage, Haman was filled with wrath. But he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had told him of the people of Mordecai. Instead, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, the people of Mordecai. So he's not just content to punish Mordecai. Haman wants to take out all of Mordecai's people. He wants to annihilate the Jewish people. Now, did you notice in verse 1, it speaks of Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite. Now, some people think that this just means he's from the Persian province of Agag. Others think that he's a descendant of Agag, the king of the Amalekites. Do you remember the Amalekites were kind of like the Philistines? They were perennial enemies of Israel. The Amalekites are the ones that attacked the stragglers of Israel when Moses was leading them out of Egypt. The slow pokes, the older folks that can't keep up, here come the Amalekites and start wiping them out. And that's where Joshua goes out and he starts fighting against them. And if you remember, Moses is on the hill and he's got the rod of God in his hand. And whenever he has the rod of God lifted up, Joshua is being victorious over the Amalekites. But whenever his hands get tired and the rod starts going down, then the Amalekites start winning over Joshua. And that's where Aaron and Hur come in and hold up the arms of Moses so that Joshua ultimately gets the victory. And they call that place Jehovah Nissi. We are going to fight under the name of the Lord our God. He is our banner. And God told them, you're going to have trouble with the Amalekites from now on. And so we fast forward to the days of the first king of Israel, King Saul, and Samuel the prophet comes to him and says, you need to go and utterly wipe out the Amalekites. And so Saul goes and he wipes out a lot of them, but he keeps the spoils. And he also keeps their king, King Agag, alive as a trophy and brings him back. And that's that spot where Saul comes back and says, well, I've done all that the Lord's commanded me to do. And remember, Samuel responded and says, well, what is this bleating of the sheep and the lowing of the oxen that I hear? He says, oh, well, we brought these animals back to sacrifice to the Lord your God. And this is where Samuel said in 1 Samuel 15:22, has the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed than the fat of rams. For rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft, and stubbornness is as iniquity and idolatry. Because you've rejected the word of the Lord, he also has rejected you from being king. There's such a great principle in that right there, that God would rather have us obey him than go through the religious rituals. Under the old covenant, it was bringing the animals for sacrifice. With us today, it would be what? What are some of the religious rituals that we go through? Coming to church, right? Coming to church, singing the songs, reading our Bibles, giving money to the church. If we're doing all of that and yet we're not obeying God, if we're living a life of compromise, God would say, you know what? I don't really want any of that. I would rather have your life right with me. It's like David said, sacrifice and offering you have not desired. If you did, then that's what I would give to you. But what you want is a broken heart, a broken and a contrite heart. These, O God, you will not despise. A heart that's humbled before him. And remember, Jesus said, if you love me, you'll keep my commandments. That's how we really show our love for God, isn't it? Is by obeying him and what he's called us to do. And so because of this, Saul is no longer king. But what's ironic about all of this is that it's an Amalekite that ends up being the one who takes credit for killing Saul. Saul ends up dying in a battle against the Philistines. He dies on Mount Gilboa. He's hit by the archers, and he knows that the Philistines are going to come and just make sport of him. And so he falls on his sword and presumably dies. But when word comes to David, it's an Amalekite that comes and tells David that Saul's dead and said, you know, I came and I saw that he was, you know, just there in his misery, so I put him out of his misery by killing him. Now, if Saul had taken care of the Amalekites, that guy wouldn't have been there to put him out of his misery. And what's interesting, as we see right here, is we've got Haman. If, in fact, he is an Amalekite, we've got the enemy of God's people now wanting to completely exterminate the Jewish people and wipe them out. The principle is this. If we don't get rid of the Amalekites in our life, if we don't get rid of the sin which so easily ensnares us, it will come back and it will destroy us. So when God brings those things to our mind, we need to say no and get rid of it from our life and stop doing it and start doing what God has called us to do. So back to our story, long rabbit trail on that one right there. So here we have Haman, and here he is really irate at Mordecai, and so he wants to completely take them out. So we read in verse 7 of chapter 3, in the first month, which is the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast Pur, that is the lot, before Haman, to determine the day and the month until it fell on the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. This is where they get the name for the Feast of Purim. The word Pur means lot. So basically it's like, well, when are we going to exterminate all the Jews? I don't know. Let's draw straws, or let's throw the dice and see which day of the year we should go ahead and do it. And so they do that, and the lot falls on the last month. And again, can't you see the providence of God in this? It's like a year later, rather than it being the next day. Here it's a year later where the Jews have time to do something about it. You know, how can we protect ourselves with all of this? It says in Proverbs 16:33, the lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord. What does that tell you about chance? So word goes out. We're going to kind of slide through chapter 3, and the writers go out to tell everybody about... In other words, the king gives Haman the go-ahead to wipe out the Jews, and he sends out riders into the provinces to be able to go and make this word known. Let's just read verse 15 of chapter 3. The couriers went out, hastened by the king's command, and the decree was proclaimed in Shushan, the citadel. So the king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Shushan was perplexed. And so... you know, the city's in confusion, rightfully so. Why are all the Jews going to be exterminated? And in reality, the people are probably thinking, are we going to be next? Is our king this crazy? I mean, he's just sitting down and having a cold one while this whole race is going to be totally wiped out. Now, look what happens when word gets to Mordecai in chapter 4. When Mordecai learned all that had happened, he tore his clothes and put on sackcloth and ashes and went out into the midst of the city. He cried out with a loud and bitter cry. I don't know if he's thinking, you know what, this is all because of me. If I hadn't been so, you know, stiff-necked and mean to this guy, then my whole people wouldn't be in jeopardy right now. I don't know if that's what he's thinking, but he's out there definitely impacted by this. And word gets to Esther, And so Esther sends a person to go, what's going on? And Mordecai sends word back and says, this is the decree. All of our people are going to be wiped out. And Mordecai tells Esther, you need to go before the king on behalf of your people. And you need to intercede for them so that he doesn't allow this thing to take place. And Esther responds by going, I can't go before the king because it's the law. If you go before the king and you haven't been summoned, he's going to put you to death unless he holds out the royal scepter. And so Esther responds to Mordecai in verse 10. All the king's servants and the people of the king, I'm sorry, verse 11. All the king's servants and the people of the king's province know that any man or woman who goes into the inner court to the king who has not been called, he has but one law, put all to death, except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter, that he may live. Yet I myself have not been called to go into the king these 30 days. So they told Mordecai Esther's words. And Mordecai told them to answer Esther, verse 13, do not think in your heart that you will escape in the king's palace any more than all the other Jews. For if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this? Who knows if God has allowed you to become the queen over Persia for just this time, so that you can be there to intercede on behalf of your people. And I can't help but think about that with all of us. You know, who knows that God maybe hasn't put us in the positions we're in right now for such a time as this, in the place that you live, with the people that you know, the acquaintances that you know, the opportunities that God brings your way. And I guess the question that I have really for all of us, are we gonna allow God to have his way in our lives? Are we going to be like the Apostle Paul who said, I've been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me. And the life which I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. So, you know, we become Christians. Are we really going to acknowledge and recognize that I have been bought at a price and I'm no longer my own? And really my life is to be, well, given to him in the sense that it's not me living anymore. It's him living his life through me. Are we at that place where we can do that? Say, God, I don't want my will to be done. I want your will to be done in my life. And I believe, I sincerely do, that God has a plan for each one of our lives, a certain destiny, if you will, that he wants us to fulfill. It says in Ephesians chapter 2, verse 10, for we are his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God has prepared beforehand that we should walk in them. It's like he is the poet. We're his workmanship. The word workmanship is the Greek poema. We get our word poem from that. So it's like he's the poet and we're the clean sheet of paper, and he wants to write this beautiful symphony, if you will, out of our lives. Created in Christ Jesus. Once you became a Christian, it's like you're now under the mold, if I can switch analogies right now or metaphors, it's like we're the clay and he's the potter and he wants to make something beautiful out of each one of our lives. I guess the question is, are we going to stay on the potter's wheel? You know, just like, and this is what I believe, just like we have the choice to receive Christ as our Savior and become Christians, I feel like we have the choice as well whether to allow him to work in our lives, to stay on the potter's wheel and allow him to fashion us into those beautiful vessels that he wants to make us into. Who knows that you've been positioned where you are, the people you know, the opportunities that you and I have for such a time as this to make a difference, to step out of our comfort zones, you know, and be used by him. So look at Esther's response in chapter 4, verse 15. Then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, go gather all the Jews who are present in Shushan and fast for me. Neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day. My maids and I will fast likewise. And so I will go to the king, which is against the law. And if I perish, I perish. She's willing to risk her life, isn't she? For the sake of her people, she's willing to put her life on the line, stepping out of her comfort zone. She's really, kind of like we sang earlier, she's surrendered, isn't she? Lord, whatever you want to do in my life, in essence. And so what ends up happening as we move into chapter 5, Esther goes before the king, and the king does hold out the golden scepter, and she's allowed to come into his presence. And he says, what do you want, Esther? I'll give you whatever you want, up to half the kingdom. And Esther says, I want you and I want Haman to come to a banquet that I've prepared. And so they come to the banquet. And so the king says to Esther, Esther, what is it that you want? I'll give you up to half the kingdom. And she goes, I'd like you and Haman to come to a banquet tomorrow that I'm going to have for you guys. And I don't know if she's just dragging her feet because she's scared to bring this up before him or what. But that's the case. She's going to have them come back for another feast the next day. And so Haman leaves at this time. And we look at chapter 5, beginning from verse 9. And it says, so Haman went out that day joyful and with a glad heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, and that he did not stand or tremble before him, he was filled with indignation against Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home, and he sent and called for his friends and his wife Zeresh. Verse 11 of chapter 5. Then Haman told them of his great riches, the multitude of his children, everything in which the king had promoted him, and how he had advanced him above the officials and servants of the king. Moreover, Haman said, besides, Queen Esther invited no one but me to come in with the king to the banquet that she prepared. And tomorrow I'm again invited by her along with the king. Yet all this avails me nothing so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. Isn't that so much like us, you know? We can have all these great things happening in our life, but there's just one little thing that just robs us of our joy. And that's how it is for Haman right here. And so, notice the great counsel of his wife, verse 14. Then his wife Zeresh and all his friends said to him, let a gallows be made 50 cubits high, and in the morning suggest to the king that Mordecai be hanged on it. Then go merrily with the king to the banquet. And the thing pleased Haman, so he had the gallows made. These people just seem a little bit different to me and their mentality and so forth. And so he's going to go and he's going to request, let's go ahead and put Mordecai the Jew to death. And yet at this night, it just so happens, and this is where I think you see God's hand of providence, it just so happens that on that night, the king can't sleep. And so he tells one of his aides, you know, bring me something boring to read so that I can fall asleep. And so they bring the history, the chronicles of Persia. And it just so happens that he comes to the spot and reads about how Mordecai, remember back in chapter 2, about how Mordecai came and he overheard the plot to assassinate the king. And he told the queen, and the queen told the king in Mordecai's name. And so the king said, has anything been done for Mordecai to reward this person? It's like, no, nothing's been done. And it's like the king is, we've got to reward this guy. So this is the stage that's set while Haman is coming, going, we need to hang this guy. And the king's going, we need to reward this guy. So that's where we're going to take it up in chapter 6, beginning from verse 6. Chapter 6, verse 6. So Haman came in, and the king asked him, what shall be done for the man whom the king delights to honor? Now Haman thought in his heart, whom would the king delight to honor more than me? And Haman answered the king, for the man whom the king delights to honor, let a royal robe be brought, which the king has worn, and a horse on which the king has ridden, which has a royal crest placed on its head. Then let this robe and horse be delivered to the hand of one of the king's most noble princes, that he may array the man whom the king delights to honor. Then parade him on horseback through the city square and proclaim before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. Then the king said to Haman, hurry, take the robe and the horse as you've suggested, and do so for Mordecai the Jew who sits within the king's gate. Leave nothing undone of all that you've spoken. I imagine people just cheer when this is read, you know, today at the feast at that point. Verse 11, so Haman took the robe and the horse, arrayed Mordecai, and led him on horseback through the city square and proclaimed before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. Afterward, Mordecai went back to the king's gate, but Haman hurried to his house mourning and with his head covered. So it didn't turn out the way Haman was hoping. And when he gets back, basically his wife says, you know what? I don't think it's going to go really good for you, you know? So they come and they whisk Haman off to the banquet that Queen Esther has prepared. And now we're in chapter 7, verse 1. So the king and Haman went to dine with Queen Esther. And on the second day at the banquet of wine, the king again said to Esther, what is your petition, Queen Esther? It shall be granted you. And what is your request? Up to half the kingdom, it shall be done. Then Queen Esther answered and said, If I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it pleases the king, let my life be given me at my petition, and my people at my request. For we have been sold, my people and I, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. Had we been sold as male and female slaves, I would have held my tongue, although the enemy could never compensate for the king's loss. So King Ahasuerus answered and said to Queen Esther, who is he, and where is he who would dare presume in his heart to do such a thing? And Esther said, the adversary and enemy is this wicked Haman. So Haman was terrified before the king and queen. Then the king arose in his wrath from the banquet of wine and went into the palace garden. But Haman stood before Queen Esther, pleading for his life, for he saw that evil was determined against him by the king. When the king returned from the palace garden to the place of the banquet of wine, Haman had fallen across the couch where Esther was. Then the king said, will he also assault the queen while I am in the house? As the word left the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. Now Harbona, one of the eunuchs, said to the king, look, the gallows 50 cubits high, which Haman made for Mordecai, who spoke good on the king's behalf, is standing at the house of Haman. Then the king said, hang him on it. So they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. Then the king's wrath subsided. And I imagine there's even a bigger applause at that point right there, because the enemy of the Jews, the ones that wanted to wipe out all of God's people, it has come back upon his own head. And when I look at this, I think about Haman and how he didn't factor in, did he? And he probably didn't expect anybody in the higher ups of Persia to be a Jew. He probably never thought that would be the case. So when Esther, you know, is there as a Jewish person who's close to the king, who can intercede, it just totally thwarts the plan of Haman. And when I thought about that, I thought about how Satan put into the heart of Judas Iscariot to betray Jesus. And I thought about how Satan probably looked at the Son of God dying upon the cross as a great victory. Actually ends up becoming his defeat, doesn't it? Because it's through death that Jesus destroyed the one who had the power of death. That is the devil, it tells us in Hebrews chapter 2. Upon the cross, Jesus made a way for all of humanity to come through him to the Father. You see, the devil, what does it say? He's come to steal, to kill, and to destroy. He hates God. He hates God's people. And so I'm sure in his mind, he's thinking, oh, the Son of God, I'm going to get Judas to turn on him and they're going to crucify him. Yay, I've won. But actually it's his biggest defeat, because now we all have that opportunity to be forgiven of our sin and to come into God's presence, and Satan can't touch us. That's awesome, isn't it? And so similar in this, the seed of the woman has crushed the head of the serpent. Okay, let's just wrap it up with two more verses of chapter 8. Chapter 8, verse 1. On that day, King Ahasuerus gave Queen Esther the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews. And Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had told how he was related to her. So the king took off his signet ring, which he had taken from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai. And Esther appointed Mordecai over the house of Haman. This, I think, would be a great example of poetic justice. The problem still remains. The law has gone out. On the 13th of Adar, on the 12th month, the people legally have the right to rise up to kill the Jews and to take their goods. And so they can't change the law. That's the deal with the law of the Medes and the Persians. Once a law goes into effect, even the king himself can't change it. That's a whole deal with Daniel in the lion's den in Daniel chapter 6, why Darius the king couldn't change that law once he knew Daniel's enemies were just doing that to get him thrown in there. And so what has to happen here, even because that first law will stand, there has to be a second decree that goes out. And that's what they do, is they craft up a second decree where the Jews on the 13th of Adar, they're able to stand up and fight for themselves. And they can defend themselves. And if they're successful, they can take the spoils of the people who were trying to attack them. And so that second law is put into effect. I'm going to take a look at that. I think about the situation that humanity has. You know, we have that first covenant that came. We have the law of God under the old covenant, which shows us God's standards, how he is perfectly holy. And under the law, we find that the soul that sins shall die. The penalty for sin is death. And the Bible tells us that all have sinned and fallen from the grace of God. And so you can't really do away with the first law, can you? I mean, you can't have God just going, well, I guess I don't care if you guys murder each other and commit adultery and so forth. No, his standards are still there. It has to be something new that is brought in. And that's where we have the new covenant, where Jesus came and he lays his life down. It's the idea of a substitute. There needs to be life for life. The law has been broken. The penalty is death. That was the whole picture in the animal sacrificial system. But it was pointing towards Jesus, who would come in and be the substitute. He would be there in our place, bearing our judgment so that we can be forgiven. What a great picture this is of that. You've got the first that stands, so we need to bring in the second in order to counter that. And that's what Jesus has done for each one of us. You know, we look in this story, we see Queen Esther willing to risk her life, and yet we see Jesus laying down his life, giving his life for us. Jesus said in John 15:13, greater love has no one than this, than to lay down one's life for his friends. Jesus died to deal with sin and to offer us forgiveness. I want to leave us with 2 points. Number one, if you've come out and you're not a Christian, I encourage you, I invite you to come to him. He will forgive you of your sin. Number two, for us who are Christians, let's surrender afresh our lives to him. Just like Paul said, it's no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me. Let's commit afresh ourselves to the Lord so that his plan might be realized through our life. Because again, I believe he has an awesome plan for each one of us, and it's so easy for us to get derailed from that plan. So if you find yourself in a derailed state, then just commit afresh to the Lord today. God, I want your will done in my life. Amen.